5. No rewards for second place. Competition motivates me. Rankings motivate me. It pushes me to action. Darcy. Rainey was born in Los Angeles, where year-round sunshine graces park outings, lactation consultants make house calls, and daycare providers believe in infant choice, free-form play, and locally sourced juices of cucumber and carrot. Our California playdates were typically sun-kissed affairs, with parents sipping Pinot Noir and paring down a wheel of brie as children wandered around a grassy park. I found the Chinese equivalent less relaxing. There are few good neighborhood parks in the bustling megacity of Shanghai. Land is simply too valuable, and local government too pressed to spur growth to develop an open space purely for enjoyment. So, near the end of Rainey's first year, we were invited to meet half a dozen of his classmates in the basement playroom of a 7-tower apartment complex, each tower stretching 20, 30, or more stories into the sky. The entire affair started with an inquisition and ended with a foot race. "What's Rainey's birth date and height?" Mom One asked me, 5 seconds after I arrived. I answered, and she immediately launched a rapid mental calculation. "That makes Rainey the second oldest in class number 4, she told me.
"My son is the oldest," Mom Two jumped in. "His birthday is September 27th, so he's older by
2 weeks," said Mom Three.
"Yep, and Rainey is the third tallest in the class,"
Mom Two declared. I nodded, slightly stunned. Did she have all these numbers in her head? Next, the mothers maneuvered the children into race position. In all, there were 5 boys. One mother lined them up at the edge of the room, an expansive space carpeted in bright orange and gray. I glanced over at Rainey and was surprised to see that he slotted himself into place. He was on all fours, nose pointed toward the opposite wall. One mother lifted her arm dramatically, then dropped it.
"Ippei, chi! Ready, go!"
The greyhounds were off. The children crawled, arms and legs cycling rapidly as their little bodies hurtled toward the opposite side of the room. I'd never seen my son move so fast, his feet up in the air as he lurched forward on his hands and knees.
"Jiao, jiao!
Add oil, add oil!" chimed the voices of several mothers, using a common Chinese cheer. The woman who launched the race slapped her hands together, making piercing sounds.
"Go faster, go faster!"
One of the mothers clapped beside her boy, running the entire distance in her pumps as he crawled. One little boy fell behind immediately, and by the midpoint, he simply stopped, splaying his arms and legs out flat as he plopped his belly onto the carpet. He lay there, carcass spent, for the remainder of the race.
"Jiao, jiao! Add oil, add oil!"
The voices were cacophonous, and they echoed throughout the clubhouse as the remaining boys continued on. When the winner reached the wall, he immediately turned around, watching the rest of the pack advance on his tail. Rainey came in second. The boy who touched the wall third began to cry. Clapping ensued as the mothers cheered the end of the race.
100 points for Tian Tian! 100 points for Tian Tian!
One mother said.
"They're so competitive with each other," one exclaimed, laughing, as several women rushed up to congratulate the winner.
Rainey sat with his back against the wall. He was neither joyous nor upset. He was just taking it all in. His first Chinese playdate. As I pondered what about that gathering had so troubled me, I realized it was the American in me, which declared self-esteem a holy grail in parenting and education. Americans generally hold a child's regard for self, an emotional evaluation of one's own worth, with feather-soft gloves as if it were a panda cub, which requires special care because it is blind at birth, immobile, and unable to feed itself. A child's self-esteem is treated almost as a physical organ, nearly as important as the beating heart, which pumps blood to the brain, organs, and extremities. Self-esteem is the concept that compels adults to give every child a trophy, no matter if they finished dead last in the neighborhood bike race. Along this vein, American parents generally refrain from openly comparing children, in line with a culture that values the individual and her feelings. It's impolite to utter which child is smarter, better, faster, or shows leadership qualities that others don't have. If you must compare children, find a circle of best friends and whisper over Thursday morning coffee. The Chinese have a more utilitarian approach. Self-esteem doesn't exist in the Chinese lexicon, at least not in the way Americans use it. In China, a child's regard for herself is rarely as important as a stark evaluation of performance. Almost as if childhood were an Olympic sport, the Chinese rank children on everything from work ethic to Chinese character recognition and musical skill. Comparisons can be informal and conversational. "He's not as smart as his brother, but he's a better singer," my acquaintance Ming said to me once, nodding at one of her boys, in earshot of the less smart brother. Sometimes the desire to rank is combined with a threat.
"Does your father love your brother more?"
a Chinese teacher once asked my friend Rebecca's daughter. The question came after the girl had a bad showing on an in-class assignment. One time, teacher Chen told Rainey, in front of all his classmates,
"Your Mandarin is not good."
Rankings can also be formal and public, and in a Chinese education, the comparisons start early. At Songqingling, the monstrous bulletin board that sits outside of Rainey's classroom was the home for public ranking for small class number 4. Big board might post teacher's assessments of each child, a report card displayed for all to see. Who clocked in timely arrivals at school? Which child greeted the teacher with a smile? Who finished every lunchtime grain of rice? Star stickers and happy faces were pasted next to the names of each child who'd made the grade. Other times, a chart might be offered, with the names and numbers of 28 children in the leftmost column. Each succeeding column listed some kind of data point. The first time I saw the height and weight chart, my eye went straight to my son's numbers. In December of his small class year, he weighed 16.7 kilograms, 36.8 pounds, and stood 105.6 centimeters, almost 3 feet 6 inches tall. It's not surprising that my eyes didn't stop there. It was simply instinctual to begin scanning the rest of the numbers to see how Rainey stacked up. The setup of the chart itself invited comparison and competition. Only little Lee and little Wu were taller than Rainey. Just as the playdate moms had said, Rainey was the third tallest in the class. He was 0.4 kilograms heavier than little Hong, and at this, I have to admit, I felt like doing a little fist pump. The next week, eye exam results were posted, as well as the children's hemoglobin levels. Rainey's was inside normal. A few children clearly suffered from anemia, and a urinalysis would be forthcoming, the teachers wrote at the bottom of the notice. In the United States, medical privacy advocates might march on the principal's office, but they'd have trouble in China, where the government bans organized protest and the Chinese word yinsi, or privacy, had the negative connotation of having something to hide, until just a few decades ago in the cultural lexicon. As the months passed into that first year of school, Big Board began to display information that more directly compared performance and ability, as if some master had declared that it was time to up the ante. With each presentation, parents gathered eagerly, and I could always tell when Big Board posted new information by the number of bodies gathered around, heads bobbing with anticipation. The following year, the Big Board would display prowess at recorder play, for all to see. The ring finger of student number 20 is not stable. Student number 30 doesn't cover the old hole while changing to a new one. Student number 16 doesn't blow out enough air. Student number 3 doesn't cover the holes properly. Beside Rainey's number, number 27, the teacher had scrawled the same punishing diagnosis as that for number 8. Doesn't follow rhythm. My son was rhythmically deficient. I knew I'd have to get used to these types of feelings as my child was in Chinese school. So I stood there, letting feelings of shame and regret envelop me. Yet, at the tail end of the wave of emotion came a determination to do better.
We'll practice harder, I declared to Rainey, like a parent making a New Year's resolution.
In a Chinese student's later school years, exam results would be posted, with each person assigned a rank by class and grade level. It never ceased to amaze me that, without fail, the average Chinese student placed these numbers on the tips of their tongues. I'd not yet met a single Chinese school kid who couldn't recite his current ranking. And this went for kids I would meet in rural areas, too.
Number 64 out of 400 students in my grade, one high school student told me.
Little Pumpkin's master teacher Wong recited the numbers for her daughter, Cindy.
Sixth in math, fifth in English, ninth in Chinese, and fourth in physics out of 47 classmates. Overall, she's 86 out of 395 kids in her grade.
These weren't good marks, and Wong had glanced at the floor. For my own parents, there was only ever one number worth mentioning. When I was 12 years old, I'd wanted nothing more than a furry mammal to call my own. Unfortunately, my parents considered the tradition of domesticating animals a little odd, and keeping a pet simply didn't fit their life equation. My preteen self carefully considered her options. A dog wouldn't pass muster, as they were expensive and required emotional care. Cats made my mother sneeze. Gerbils were small and cheap. And I announced my desire at dinner one evening.
No, Mom responded, resolutely. Gerbils are dirty. They smell.
A gerbil will take time from your studies,
Ba exclaimed.
We don't keep pets, Mom concluded.
When she was my age, she'd just immigrated to America with her family, who spoke little English at the time. From her point of view, if she'd been given a pet rodent at the age of 12, she wouldn't have worked her way into a PhD and a professorship.
Sarah has a gerbil,
I offered.
We're not Sarah's parents, Mom responded.
As my 14th birthday approached, the mosquitoes and summer heat yielded a stroke of luck. Via my grandmother, we received news about my cousin Fong. The girl had been invited to play a regional piano concert in Pennsylvania. She'd eventually play a solo at Carnegie Hall as a teenager, the ultimate honor for a pianist. Motivated to action, my parents made an offer.
Take first place, number one, and you'll get your gerbil, my mother said.
The goal would be a piano competition that drew contestants from all over the Houston area. It was a calculated bribe, designed to coax out as much effort as humanly possible. At the time, the rivalry between Fong's mother and mine, sisters 2 years apart who gave birth the same year, was legendary. In Chinese culture, not only is it fine to use competition as an incentive, but even better if the competitor is a relative. After all, a failure against a cousin competitor dished up proof that your genetics are perfectly fine, and that it's a lack of effort that has slotted you for a lifetime of mediocrity.
Fong plays piano so well. You should practice more like her,
my grandmother told me once, egging me on. Fong was also twig thin, whereas I was fleshy, and she stayed porcelain pale during the summertime, while the sun browned my face in a hot second. But I figured I'd focus on one thing at a time. Like any good Chinese daughter, I'd been playing piano since I was potty trained. My parents have pictures of my 4-year-old self tapping out scales while perched on a piano bench, a phone book propping up my tiny feet, photographic evidence of forced musicality. By my preteen years, I'd been practicing at least an hour a day for 8 years. To me, piano was an 88-key beast that sat in our living room and kept me away from Kirk Cameron and Growing Pains reruns. But for a gerbil, I could eke out one last triumph.
You'll play for release, my mother decreed.
Beethoven is much beloved by the Chinese because, as conductor Cai Jindong explained, the Chinese value those who chi ku, or eat bitter. And Beethoven definitely was a man who worked hard. Born a commoner, Beethoven lost a string of paramours to class differences,
battled an ongoing string of serious illnesses, and began going deaf in his 20s. Still, he continued to create music and remains one of the world's most influential composers. Beethoven is a classic story of hard luck overcome by effort. For 2 months, I practiced, sweated, and labored over Beethoven. At night, I dreamed about Beethoven, and during the daylight hours, my mother tapped out time on my shoulder with a ruler while my fingers cavorted like horses trotting on the keyboard. Some days I practiced so much that I was surprised when I looked down to see slender and intact fingers rather than overworked red nubs. In this way, for 2 straight months, our little mother-daughter ensemble moved toward the finish line. I don't remember much about the day of competition. Before a panel of judges and an audience of mostly Asian parents, I got through for release. But my fingers jerked when they should have frolicked like prancing ponies and plodded where they should have been light as a butterfly's landing. I remember the smugness of the winner, also a Chinese daughter, in the large, raised brown mole that stared at me from above her eyelid. As our eyes caught briefly during the award ceremony, I thought I detected a flicker of darkness, and perhaps a hint of her own unspoken hell. On the way home, I pleaded and cried and made excuses. "I'm a good pianist. You know I can play for Elise," I whined to my parents from the backseat of our car. "I had a stomach ache today." My parents were silent. "Can I have the gerbil anyway?" I asked. My parents did not buy me a gerbil, despite the fact that I practically went on a preteen hunger strike. I plotted to run away from home. I cursed Fong, though she deserved every accolade. As a teenager, she developed de Kervain's tenosynovitis in her left wrist, likely from overpractice. Still, no gerbil. That's how I learned that in the Chinese way, there are no rewards for second place. Certainly, overemphasizing competition can be dangerous. Too many years of competition, and you start to see everyone around you as someone to outrank, Amanda told me. By the end of Rainey's first year in Chinese kindergarten, I'd begun meeting with Amanda more frequently, usually at a downtown Starbucks. I had questions about Chinese education. Teachers Chen and Tsai would be of limited use. They thought my son was an animal and that his mother needed re-education. So I sought out Amanda, knowing instinctively that any Chinese high school student who quoted Nietzsche was a deep thinker. "Coffee black with lots of sugar," Amanda had told me at our first meeting. "I drink a cup a day now." Just 18 years old, she'd spent her junior year in high school studying alongside U.S. teenagers, and I laughed at the idea that among America's gifts to her was a lingering caffeine addiction. The first time we'd arranged to meet, I'd scanned the crowd of young professionals chatting animatedly over lattes at a Starbucks near our home, and my eyes were immediately drawn to a tiny figure whose stone-white windbreaker hung on her waif-like frame. The girl had straight black hair that swung past her waist, and she was bent over an e-reader, reading through lenses with no frames, oblivious to the bustle around her. "There she is," I thought, "the product of a Chinese education." Amanda was stellar in almost every way valued by the Chinese. A top-ranking student, a model UN delegate, an exchange student to America. From the outside, she was exactly what I'd expected. The inside, I'd come to discover, would be a surprise. "Shanghai kindergarten never suited me," Amanda said. "Neither did elementary, middle, or high school, for that matter. I was always the odd girl out." When I stared at her, I imagined a teenage Rainey or a full-grown little pumpkin. "Why?" I asked her from across the table. "I like reading Proust and Camus," she said. No one else did. While her classmates memorized Mao Zedong quotes, she preferred reading snippets of Western philosophy. She cared nothing for Chinese pop stars, which her female classmates idolized and chattered about during breaks. There was also the fact that during her 12-year school career, she'd never been selected banzhang, or class monitor, a position of power and influence in the classroom. "I was always on the outside. It might be hard for you to understand," she told me. looking across at her, sipping her Americano with 2 packets of sugar. I imagined the adult version of a young school child, suffering the invisible bruises of being pushed into a cast iron mold. Was she the kid who goes down the slide head first? Actually, I told her, I think I have an idea. The picture she painted was grim. After years of being forced to gulp down lunch, a ritual that she says started in kindergarten, she's neutral to food and doesn't view eating as a pleasure. On her first day of preschool, she'd cried so violently that the teachers walled her off in an empty classroom. She remembers feeling shame and embarrassment. Then there was the psyche cultivated by years of existing inside a classroom with pressure to conform. Every time I'm in a crowd, it's so weird. I lose my autonomy, she told me. If there are a lot of people, at a party, I try to blend myself into the conversation. I try to imitate their emotion. I make myself like everyone else in the crowd. I lose myself. Then there was the feeling of being trapped in a race that never relents. When I'm not studying, I feel like I'm being lazy. When I am studying, I feel that someone is always doing more, she said. It was a mentality cultivated by a lifetime of competition. There's only one definition of a kid in China: a good student who rises above the rest. I don't know how else to be. But something is working, I pressed her. You say your value system is flawed, that competition has ruined your mind. But if you look at just the academics, you're a star. During her year at that New England high school, Amanda had found her math abilities 3 years ahead of her American classmates. And she soon confirmed her prowess on a larger stage. She'd entered a nationwide math competition with thousands of entrants and placed in the top 50. Does competition make you a better student? I asked. She bobbed her head, slowly. Maybe. My parents told me, just wait, you'll see. It will all be worth it. What will be worth it? The sacrifice, the pressure, the competition, she said, feeling like I always needed to work harder. Amanda's family was shooting high. This year she would be applying to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, the California Institute of Technology, and a handful of other top American colleges. The sacrifice would be worth it, they said. Amanda repeated, almost to herself. What do you think?
I don't know,
Amanda said, slowly.
We'll see.
Amanda had returned from the United States buzzing with doubts about her own educational experience, and I'd landed in China with just as many questions about our son's place in the system. Let's figure it out together, I told her, and she nodded. Where Amanda was uncertain, Darcy knew very firmly where he stood on competition.
Competition motivates me. Rankings motivate me, Darcy told me.
Darcy was a tracksuit-clad teenager of 17 when I first met him in Shanghai, a boy with smooth skin and a shy smile bookended by dimples. A teacher friend put us in touch around the same time I'd met Amanda, and we found that our interests aligned perfectly. I wanted to interview a Shanghai high school student, and Darcy wanted to befriend a foreigner. We began meeting every 2 weeks. Where Amanda was the odd girl out, Darcy seemed to have everything neatly in place. He liked to tease his thick, black hair forward so that it sat, frozen, like an ocean wave about to break on his sloping forehead. He was of good height. He dressed out of the pages of a teen sports magazine, with Nikes on his feet and latest model mobile phone in hand. He'd chosen the English name Darcy because he was drawn to the aloof yet debonair quality of Jane Austen's character. If Darcy's mother and father were to write a marriage advertisement to post in Shanghai's People's Square, where many anxious parents gather to matchmake and try to marry off their children, it might say, 175 centimeters, born in 1996, a top Shanghai high school graduate, good moral standing, good qualities, destined for a top-tier university. Darcy's only flaw, in his words, was his physique.
A body wasted away by study.
He liked to joke. At one of our early meetings, I was intent on drilling down the meaning of competition. Competition might motivate you, but what about the shame that happens when a student finds out he's not at the very top? I asked.
When my scores get lower, a ranking gets lower. It motivates me to think about how to achieve more, he told me. It pushes me to action.
Once his math teacher complained that his former students were far superior. Darcy, sitting in the classroom that day, told me he felt ashamed. The next week, he scored number one on his math final.
I wanted to prove my worth to him, he told me.
But you are talking about external measures of worth, I told him. Isn't there a downside?
Sure, he said. Low-ranking students might eventually give up. But for those who are ambitious, rankings can give you a short-term goal to shoot for.
I looked over at him as he stirred his coffee. Like Amanda, he liked a strong cup of Americano. Unlike Amanda, he had few questions about his path.
The Chinese education system is not perfect, he said,
as if anticipating my skepticism.
It's a growing tree, and right now they can only focus on making the trunk strong. If the trunk grows well, then the flowers can blossom.
Part of making the trunk strong, I knew, was to continue this practice of filtering out students in a country of 1.4 billion people. Not everyone could make it through. Ranking and sifting the masses is a practice that dated back to dynastic times, when entire towns might gather in the main square or marketplace to await final results of the imperial exam. Back then, it was the Zhuangyuan Ban, the champion list, that drew the crowds, just as Big Board drew the attention of parents and grandparents today. The champion list changed the fates of families, almost overnight. I decided to read up on student life in Imperial China. What was the day-to-day like for those kids whose sights were set on that champion list? It turns out it was no easy road, then or now. If you were a Chinese boy in the year AD 605, you spent most of your waking hours huddled over classic texts. Your future depended on how well you could memorize passages such as this one from the I Ching. When flowing water meets with obstacles on its path, a blockage in its journey, it pauses. It increases in volume and strength, filling up in front of the obstacle and eventually spilling past it. The words were flowery, the meanings arcane. And there were a lot of them, more than 400,000 characters in total to commit to memory in the poems, speeches, passages, and annotations of the four books and five classics of Confucian thought. Daunted, you might feel compelled to drop your calligraphy brush and abandon study. One scholar estimated a young child would spend at least 6 years or more in 7 days a week study. But the emperor of the Sui dynasty needed ministers and officials. He'd decided a grueling 3-day exam would ensure the quality of men who would govern in his imperial court. And so an entire nation of male aspirants bent their heads over books and diligent study. Girls, of course, needn't apply. Women with ambition could only educate themselves in hopes of supporting a spouse or son in their testing quest. The ladder to social and economic status had many rungs, and on each rung sat an exam. First were the provincial level tests, then came the district tests, the metropolitan exams, and finally the national level exams. The most extraordinary men might find themselves entering imperial court for the mother of all tests, Jinshi. Passing the Jinshi meant the possibility of catapulting to the top and snagging an imperial bureaucratic post in the country's capital. The emperor himself might look over your essay. You cared about ascending this ladder, because to succeed meant a prize that was life-altering. An imperial position brought nothing less than prestige, status, and wealth for you, your family, and ancestors already long buried. Each rung afforded more status, and as you climbed, you distanced yourself from the carnage piled up at the base of the ladder. And that carnage was thick, as pass rates were impossibly low. At the first rung, the district level, only one or two of every 100 candidates advanced to the next level, and the odds worsened from there. As each dynasty morphed into the next, passing the exams got less and less competitive. But as recently as the year 1850, still only one man in 6,000 succeeded at all stages of the selection process. The process was mentally trying. Painter Pu Songling of the 17th century sketched out the emotions of an exam candidate. The man was a barefooted beggar when he entered the exam hall, and a sick bird out of the cage when he finished. After he failed to advance, he became a poisoned fly who burns all his books and thinks to abandon the world. That poisoned fly might later decide to continue study, but this path required Olympic-level steadfastness. During certain dynasties, the exam was offered as rarely as once every 3 years. It was a long time to wait. This system was lauded for being a meritocracy. Though, in truth, schools weren't universal and typically only nobles and merchants could afford tutors and books. In theory, at least, both the peasant who can afford only rice for dinner and the nobleman with turtle on his dinner plate could take the same test and advance through study, rung by rung. Archaic, laborious, and daunting, researcher Justin Crozier called the imperial exam system, but it was also a remarkable attempt to create an aristocracy of learning. Today, just as in imperial China, that ladder theoretically drops from the sky into every corner of the far reaches of China. The message of hope is clear. Any child can hook a thumb onto a rung of the ladder, from the daughter of a nomadic shepherd in Xinjiang province to a son of Beijing or Shanghai's urban elite. The student need only study hard, pass tests, and hope to advance to each successive level. Of course, girls may participate now, and the system has experienced a number of changes, some brought about by emperors and others prompted by war or revolution. Yet the basic system of high-stakes testing and advancement remains. A child walks that same narrow road for success that he always has. For most Chinese today, particularly the lower and middle classes, a college degree is still the surest way to secure a stable job that provides upward mobility and employs the head, not the hands. Teacher, doctor, government worker, marketer. Yet the ladder to that degree is steep, with many rungs, and advancement still requires years of back-breaking, eye-straining study. At the first rung, 5- and 6-year-olds sit for entrance exams and interviews at the best urban primary schools. Then it's entrance testing for middle schools. From there, things get really competitive with the National High School Entrance Exam, or Zhongkao. Near the top of the ladder sits the vaunted National College Entrance Exam, or Gaokao, which each year decides the fate of nearly 10 million students and determines what college he'd attend and what field he'd study. At these last two rungs of the ladder, the falloff is steep. Between 16 and 18 million students take the high school entrance exam each year, and fewer than 8 million go on to an academic high school, the cleanest path into a four-year university. Each year, a population the size of London's will sit for the college entrance exam. Yet, only 2/3 of the nearly 10 million teens who take the Gaokao will get a university spot at one of China's 1,200 colleges. And only 3 or 4% will ascend to what's called the top tier of colleges. The biggest losers on the ladder, roughly 2 million teenagers, are often relegated to non-skilled work or years of scrabble through self-employment or entrepreneurism in an increasingly competitive and resource-constrained economy. That's a lot of carnage at the base of the ladder. Every June, the Gaokao inspires a barrage of media photos, which indicate the fiercest of academic pressure cookers. Hangar-sized warehouses with row upon row of black-haired heads bowed over exam papers. Students hooked up to IV drips for energy during test prep. Busloads of students on their way to exam sites, revving past thousands of pedestrians who raise arms in salute. Throngs of anxious parents camped outside the exam hall gates. My favorite was taken by a photographer with a bird's eye view of an entrance gate. On one side of the photo are hordes of students walking shoulder to shoulder to exam rooms, while on the other side, parents wait with sun umbrellas, bottles of water, snacks, and spare pencils. The children have been sent off to battle. I once overheard a phone conversation between our IE at the time and her 13-year-old daughter, a student back home in Anhui province. Though entrance exams are certainly the most critical, a relentless churn of weekly and monthly exams riddles the path of every Chinese school child starting in first grade. I could only hear IE's side of the conversation. In this and nearly every future call I heard, the topic was the same. "Did you test already?" IE asked, speaking urgently into the mouthpiece. "Which day did you test? The score didn't come out yet? Well then, what did you think about how you tested? Did it feel easy? How many do you think you missed?" "Then," she said, leaning into the phone, "how many do you think you got right?" Because families have peered skyward at the rungs on those ladders for years, the need to study, and study hard, has always been ingrained in Chinese culture, even from a very young age. A hard work ethic becomes muscle memory. I knew we'd probably relocate home to the United States long before Rainey would be of Gaokao age. Yet, as long as Rainey was a child in this system, working alongside students trapped in this cycle of tests, study, advance, study would have to be part of his daily routine. As Rainey grew older, Big Board's tally would change from height and weight to exam results and subject proficiency. This was inevitable. It was a deeply rooted feature of Chinese education. For the moment, with what I knew, I felt okay with this prospect for my son. Growing up inside the competitive environment my parents created left me with a persistent, nagging feeling that other drivers were sprinting past me on the highway, though my own car was already at the speed limit. Yet there were also clear benefits. Like Darcy, I felt that knowing where I stood helped motivate me in key areas of my life and defined a clear goal to shoot for. Still, I wondered whether competition set inside China's test-heavy system might deliver more detrimental effects. And I made a note to watch Rainey closely. On a Wednesday toward the end of the school year, Songqingling held its annual sports competition. The meet would pit the classes of small class grade against each other in a series of physical challenges and tests. Teacher Chen, of course, had decided small class number 4 must triumph. A few weeks prior, Chen had sent out notices via WeChat, urging children to get plenty of rest and to rehearse athleticism. "We have been practicing at school for this great challenge, and we urge you to prepare at home for the big day," Teacher Chen tapped out on WeChat. The parent cacophony chimed its affirmation. Challenges might include a timed ladder climb, a sock hop, or a tricycle race around Big Green. It all sounded innocuous enough, but I figured the character of such competitions would depend on the spirit of the leadership. Sure enough, the great ball bounce of the following year would prove intense. In the weeks leading up to that meet, teachers handpicked parent and child teams and required them to huddle over basketballs at home, recording the number of bounces on gridded sheets. During morning drop-off, the school would set up practice stations on Big Green, and I observed hunch pairs of parents and children slapping down basketballs as quickly as they could. Lin Guanyu and his mother were among the victors that year, together logging an astounding 128 bounces in 10 seconds. "We'd been practicing since March and expected a top place finish. New records were created," the teachers would effuse. This year, the central challenge would be a game called Mountain Hole. "We're most worried about this last game," Teacher Chen barked at a group of parents assembled in small class number 4's classroom on the big day. The black bits between her teeth seemed as ominous as her intensity, and Rob and I joined the crowd, seated in child-sized chairs arranged stadium style, murmuring dutifully. Parent becomes student. Chen laid out the competitive landscape. "There are 5 classes in the small class grade level, and 2 of them are fast. Lightning fast. I've observed them during practices, Chen said. For these two classes, the teacher might already signal her team has finished, and the other groups hadn't even started crawling yet.
A collective gasp rippled across the room, and I saw that Teacher Chen was pleased with our reaction.
We need to plan for action, Teacher Chen concluded.
She described the mountain hole challenge in detail. Fathers would stand shoulder to shoulder on big green, rubber mats forming a path at their feet, with the children lining up at one end of the row of dads. From there, the race would unfold in two parts. In part one, the first father would grasp the child at the front of the line and pass him to the next father. Then repeat, until the entire group of children had been transported from one side of the father line to the other. Last child safely delivered, the men would then bend at the waist, hands outstretched to touch the other side of the mat to form a tunnel with their bodies.
This tunnel is the mountain hole, Chen said. For this part, the children must crawl as fast as they can in the direction from which they started.
The class whose children got down the line and back through the tunnel fastest would win. Teachers and classroom IEs would be placed strategically. One at the start to launch the children, another at the midpoint to urge for speed, and one at the finish to coax the kids home.
Mothers, you'll be cheerleaders, Chen said,
as she distributed pom-poms and horns, and I received a plastic contraption that wailed like a trussed-up duck. Battle instructions complete, we parents journeyed down to Big Green, descending the stairs in double-line formation. I clutched my horn, while Rob dutifully stepped right, left, right, mirroring the father in front of him. We arrived to find parents from small classes 2 and 3 already in the heat of practice. Spurred on, our father stepped right into the action. One man began passing an imaginary child to an imaginary waiting parent, twisting forward and back like a weather vane caught up in a tornado. Another man began bouncing, knees bending and straightening, in anticipation of bearing the weight of a child. Rob stood off to the side, taking it all in.
Shouldn't you be stretching or bouncing or something? I teased my husband, as he snorted.
Rob and I didn't relate much to the urge to win we saw in the faces of parents all around us, but we wanted to show support for our son. When the children arrived, Rainey beamed in our direction from his place in line. Chen immediately began barking orders at the kids, a sudden urgency to her voice as other classes began assembling around us on Big Green.
Stiffen your bodies and hold your elbows tight to your waists as the fathers pass you down the line, she yelled.
For the parents, she had explicit instructions on gunning for speed.
Man one, grab a child by the elbows. Man two, grab at the waist. Man three would alternate back to the elbows. Alternate the anchor point while passing the children. This way your hands won't get entangled, Chen said. Maximum efficiency, and don't drop a child. The team will be docked 5 seconds.
5 seconds?
A man bellowed, and the other parents murmured, pondering the size of this penalty. Chen offered more pointers for the tunnel part.
Men, suck in your bellies as you bend over, to allow room for children to crawl.
I'm too fat, one father yelled back.
Then do a back bend,
another responded. A needed break to the intensity.
Are you ready?
The Sung Qingling principal suddenly proclaimed, from her perch at the head of Big Green, surveying the nearly 250 children and parents gathered before her, shirts color coordinated by class. The first child in our line wore red shoes, and he held his hands high above his head, mummified, waiting to be grasped at the waist. The fathers crouched, rubbing their hands together in an attempt to roust up energy.
Ibei Chi!
Begin, urged the principal.
Red Shoes leaped into the first father's arms, and with that, the race was on. Instantaneously, the order of Big Green gave way to a screaming, maniacal mess of competitors. Parents yelled encouragement, children bounced impatiently, and teachers raced the length of their lines, urging speed. Red Shoes was passed to the next parent, and then the next, and then on down the line. The next kid followed, and the next, and pretty soon each father was grappling with a kid,
handing him off, only to quickly turn to receive the next child.
Small class number 4! Jiao! Jiao! Add oil! Add oil!
Teacher Chen yelled, her heels rarely touching earth as she scrambled the length of the line. One by one, the children were snatched and passed. Instructions were forgotten in the heat of the race. Most children forgot to keep their hands by their sides, and in their haste, the fathers forgot to alternate elbows and waists. Instead, they began grabbing at whatever body part they could make contact with, underneath armpits, on the hips, by the upper arms.
Add oil! Add oil! Add oil!
Children were grabbed and passed, grabbed and passed.
Faster, faster, faster! Faster!
Teachers Chen and Tsai traversed the length of the line, clapping and chanting. Red Shoes reached the end of the line, and he stood waiting at the west end of the tunnel. As the last child touched down, the fathers collapsed, hands touching down on the other side of the mat with their feet anchored in place, butts up in the air to form a tunnel. I recognized the back of Rob's blue jeans against the pants of the father next to him. The teachers elevated the chants as the children began to crawl.
Add oil! Add oil! Fast, 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 fast!
The noise was astounding. The kids had also begun screaming, and together they formed a mass of moving arms and legs as they crawled, one child's head so close to the preceding child's rear that they almost looked attached. Like a chain of caterpillars, the kids shimmied on hands and knees toward the west end of the mountain hole. From my vantage point, the tunnel's exit was obscured by a crowd of waiting parents gathered 3 and 4 deep. I noodled my way in until I finally caught a glimpse of the end of the mountain hole, where the children were emerging head first. There, I saw Tsai and an assistant teacher in furtive heat. They were yanking children out and tossing them into a heap at the end. The children, blinking and dazed, got up and went over to sit on the curb. They're pulling the kids out. That's cheating, I thought, in amazement. I stood on my tippy toes, peering over the heads of the thronging parents, but I couldn't see the western ends of the tunnels of the other classes. Was everyone cheating? Teacher Tsai began clearing the kids away from the end of the tunnel to prevent a traffic jam. The fathers chanted,
"Faster, faster, faster!"
I crouched down to peer at Rob, obediently perched in tunnel form about halfway down the line. Abruptly, I saw Tsai stand tall like a gazelle, craning her head to survey the landscape. There, she paused, decided it was safe, and pulled out a new tactic. Dropping to a crouch, she scooted into the tunnel to meet the next child head on. She grasped the little boy underneath the armpits and scuttled backward, dragging him with her. Once out, she turned around and tossed him onto the grass. She did this a few more times, each time meeting the next child head on in the mountain hole.
Go, go, go! Add oil, add oil!
The chants continued. I looked around, scanning faces. None of the parents standing with me seemed to register the fact that the leaders of small class number 4 were unabashedly flaunting the rules. Finally, the last child passed the perimeter. Chen's hand went up fast as lightning, as fast as the lightning strike she'd ascribed to the other teams in practice, and where seconds before she'd aimed to escape attention, now she sought out the eyes of the principal.
We won! We won! We won!
Chen announced loudly, her other hand joining the first in a frantic double-handed wave. I glanced at Teacher Tsai, and she noted my look. I detected a shimmer of embarrassment. The rest of the parents beamed, energized from the win, as the tunnel of fathers suddenly righted itself and began peeling away one by one, in search of progeny. I glanced over at the other races, but they were still in progress. Small class number 4 had cheated its way to victory. My eyes found Rob's in the horde, and, without a word, we raised our eyebrows almost in unison. I didn't want to be a killjoy, but I struggled to digest what I'd just seen. Children served an important purpose in Chinese society, making the adults in their lives look good. Here, the students had performed perfectly for teachers Chen and Tsai, who would now be celebrated by the principal before the entire school. An additional thought flashed in my mind. I knew that cheating was a well-documented problem inside the Chinese education system, and here I'd witnessed evidence of teachers taking shortcuts in the face of competition. This was just a kindergarten sports meet, but didn't it also set an example for the children of small class number 4? Did Chinese students learn this type of behavior from the men and women who stood at the front of their classrooms? Soon enough, it was time for the award presentation. The principal brandished a handwritten certificate, which declared the winner, Champions for Small Class Number 4 in the 2nd Annual Sports Meet. I am healthy because I do sports, the certificate ran, and Teacher Chen grinned as she grasped the paper with both hands. Later, Chen and Tsai assembled their children for a group photo. They posed under a red banner that stretched from tree to post and read, 2nd Annual Physical Health Competition. In the photo, which I later slotted into a pile of Song Qingling notices at home, the members of small class number 4 are lined up in 3 rows, and they are smiling. The broadest grins of all belonged to teachers Chen and Tsai, who stand in the back, leaning over their tiny students like 2 Chinese elm trees. The children seem neither overjoyed nor burdened, but simply indifferent, which seemed to me appropriate expressions for pawns in a championship game. I peered closer at Chen and Tsai. Both teachers held up 2 fingers in a V for victory.